Israel is top of mind. For 10 straight years, Benjamin Netanyahu has been Israel's prime minister, and he is hoping to continue that run in nationwide elections happening today, Tuesday. Voting has just ended, and early exit polls show Netanyahu's Likud party in a very close race, even slightly behind the primary opposition Blue and White Party for control of Israel's parliament. Earlier today, I spoke about Prime Minister Netanyahu's legacy with Matthew Brodsky, a Middle East analyst and senior fellow at the Security Studies Group. What has been Prime Minister Netanyahu's most significant accomplishment over these last 10 years in office?
Holding the line against President Obama, who took plenty of opportunities to throw Israel under the bus, was first and foremost a big accomplishment. It was not a big accomplishment preventing the Iran nuclear deal from taking shape, which he really put a lot of effort into, because, of course, that did happen. Mm. However, with the Trump administration in office, he had a pre-existing relationship with Donald Trump. And so they've maintained a really good relationship. And to the extent now that the United States, in our current iteration of foreign policy, is letting Israel take the lead in certain areas in the Middle East and is backing Israel 100%. And I think many Israelis, as they go to the polls, are very much aware that a lot of this is due to the personal relationship between Netanyahu and President Trump, but also they're bearing in mind that Netanyahu also has very good relations with President Vladimir Putin of Russia and other international players on the world stage.
Would you say that Prime Minister Netanyahu has changed in some way Israel's prominence or prestige on the global stage over these last 10 years through these relationships you're discussing?
I think in many cases, he certainly has. First of all, and a lot of this is how he played politically and the choices he made given the context of what was happening around him. For instance, the Arab Spring that quickly turned into a winter. That's something that hardly anyone was prepared for, but he understood Israel's security perspective very well. The Arab Spring also did away with the idea that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is linked to every other conflict that's happening in the region. And that used to be the main thought animating outsiders when it came to dealing with the Middle East, is if you solve this problem, then everything else goes away. Now, we realize that really that doesn't have anything to do with the problems happening in all the capitals that surround Israel. So he's done a terrific job at navigating these type of a very turbulent environment.
Has peace between Israel and the Palestinians, have we grown closer or further away from that under Netanyahu's leadership?
Under Netanyahu's leadership, we've really... The basic problem is there's a Palestinian side that's represented on one hand by the Palestinian Authority or the Fatah organization. They simply won't show up to negotiate. So they won't take yes for an answer. Their positions have not moved a centimeter since Clinton tried in 2000. Basically, what you have is a Israeli prime minister basically, again, holding the line because there is no partner on the other side. And, of course, the other half of the Palestinian politics in Gaza is run by Hamas, a terrorist group that's dedicated to Israel's destruction. So it's very difficult to get peace to occur. One thing that I think we should all bear in mind, and it's especially important to understanding that President Trump recently recognized Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights. And that's the fact that that when Israelis, the public, in the democracy, perceive that their partner on the other side truly does want peace, then they demand peace. When Anwar Sadat, Egypt's president, flew to Israel, to Jerusalem, which is the capital, of course, and spoke before the Knesset in 1977, he's the one who said, "We'll do a land for peace and we'll make a peace of the brave." And peace happened. The people were behind that. Now, the people also can smell snake oil. And so I don't know when there's something that through the Syrian peace processes, through the 90s, they could tell that this was not a serious partner, someone who was going to strategically realign against Iran. And they understand that. So I don't think the moment is all that ripe, but we'll see what the administration puts down as far as a peace plan in the upcoming weeks or months, perhaps.
This is the Trump administration. President Trump has talked about wanting some sort of peace, and there is a plan that we have yet to see, but it may come out this summer. But you mentioned that Prime Minister Netanyahu has, as you said, done a good job of holding the line in Israel with the Palestinians. But hasn't it actually been a little bit more of like pushing that line in Israel's support, or at least with the Trump administration's actions and support of Prime Minister Netanyahu? I'm thinking about moving the United States embassy to Jerusalem, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And then, of course, as you mentioned, recognizing just in the last few weeks of Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which is this contested area that Israel seized during the 1967 war, which the international community, the consensus is that that is not Israeli territory, that it's occupied territory. So it seems, is there also a view here that it's that rather than towing the line, that Prime Minister Netanyahu, with President Trump's support, are actually pushing this, lining up the cards in Israel's favor?
What they're doing is unsticking the gum that's been in the works that's prevented any forward momentum or movement for decades. And a lot of that is the mythology that exists. For instance, moving the embassy to Jerusalem. Now, again, like I said, Anwar Sadat, Egypt's president in 1977, addressed the Israeli Knesset. He flew to Jerusalem. Whenever anyone from the outside comes to talk politics or deal with the Israeli government, they do so in Jerusalem because that's where it's located. Hmm. Now, when it comes to Jerusalem, there's the western portion of Jerusalem. There's the holy city. There's eastern Jerusalem, which is what was created when Jordan occupied that portion of the city from 1948 until 1967. When Palestinians say, and when the rest of the world says, Israel has no claim to Jerusalem, there's no Jewish claim there, as Obama tried to do in the very final resolution. He succeeded in passing through the UN before he left office. That is mythology. That is the kind of thing that when Palestinians and the rest of the world think that, oh, okay, really Israel has no claim to even the parts that have always been Jewishly held. Then that's ridiculous. Okay, so people need to get specific and understand what it is that they're talking about. And too much of the world, frankly, spouts out without having a clue as to the geography, as to whether they're talking about the municipality of Jerusalem, which is 126 square miles, whether you're talking about the old city. There are different ways of looking at it, and where Jerusalem's located, where the political body is located is in the western portion of the city, on the Golan Heights, too. Once again, this is an area that the recognition that Trump gave based on Israel's 1981 annexation essentially doesn't change what's happening on the ground. It's not like Israel is about to go into a peace process with Assad and just return the territory. And clearly, from this standpoint, it's very clear that if Israel had done that, it would have been suicidal during the course of this civil war, given the rainbow of terrorist groups of all stripes that are located in Syria. Mm. So what this does is basically makes the case in the Golan Heights that if you're attacking Israel repeatedly and you lose, there are consequences. The idea only exists apparently for Israel that you can attack it, and that if it wins, then the side that loses gets to dictate terms. That's for some reason only applies to Israel and would never apply to any other country on earth. So I think what Trump has done is to basically say, no, there are rules and there are consequences. And for the Palestinian-Israeli peace conflict, I think he's flipped the idea where Obama and John Kerry had previously made Palestinians believe that time was on their side. Trump has turned that on its head and to essentially say there are consequences for your obstructionism.
I'm speaking with Matthew Brodsky. He's a Middle East analyst and senior fellow at the Security Studies Group. Who is Prime Minister Netanyahu's political base of supporters in Israel?
He's the longest serving prime minister, which says quite a lot given the volatility of the Israeli democracy. He certainly pulls from the right, but you have to understand in this context, the left has been decimated in Israel as a result of the collapse of the peace process from the 90s and 2000, and then because of the armed war of attrition that was launched by Palestinians against Israel. That's, of course, why they built a separation barrier. The idea of just trading land for peace has been so trampled as an idea, as we've seen from Israel withdrawing from Gaza, so they get rockets. Israel withdrew from southern Lebanon, and they get Hezbollah rockets over there. If they were to return to the Golan Heights, well, now there's Iran entrenched. It would be entrenched that much closer to Israel's heartland. So the entire idea of the land for peace concept has really taken a hit. So it's really a matter of from the center to the right, which parties they're going to represent. And I think even in Israel, the idea of the corruption charges that are targeting him kind of play like it plays against Trump here in the U.S. to the right, where it just seems like the other party or the establishment can't really accept the results of a democratic process in an election. They're not trying to find a way to get him out to get him out of office otherwise.
What is at stake for Palestinians with this election? Maybe you could actually speak, first of all, to how life has played out for Palestinians under Prime Minister Netanyahu's leadership and where Prime Minister Netanyahu thinks would like to go when it comes to the experience of being a Palestinian in this region.
It's more or less been a status quo, and it's been that way for a very long period of time. Even under the Obama administration, the daily life situation for Palestinians has remained fairly constant. And also, I mean, their leadership. Let's understand that Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, he's in his 14th year of what was a four-year term, you know, with no elections or anything like that on the horizon. Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, likes the status quo. It basically keeps in place what it is that they have and what they like. For Hamas, it's the same type of deal. I think if you dig down, they realize that destroying Israel, which is what they say they want to do, is really not on the near-term horizon, and yet they keep up with their missiles and their protest movement, and it's with similar results. So there's basically the day-to-day events happen within a certain spectrum that is really not all that broad at this moment. If there were new leadership, if there were accountable leaders on the Palestinian side, or a group that actually wanted to make peace that could grapple with its own mythology, I think that would absolutely move the region forward. But the fact is, on the Israeli side, the left is just simply not trusted with that because, like as I said, the fruits of those efforts coupled with the good intentions of those on the right but from giving back land has just taken a shot. You know, the nail's already in that coffin. What we just in the past few weeks have seen stray rockets claimed by Iran from their own cell that's inside of Gaza that launched as far as Tel Aviv. For Israelis to contemplate statehood in the West Bank right next to their international airport when rockets from Gaza, which is far further away, can already, presumably close the airport, that really, you would have to be fairly insane to say, yeah, no, that sounds perfectly great with given the
to go ahead and you're saying that the idea of giving granting Palestinians statehood within the West Bank territory, which they currently occupy.
Without very, very close security arrangements that would prevent that. And if you look at the reality on the ground, Hamas is not, it's not like they're non-existent in the West Bank and only in Gaza. There have, in fact, been several attacks over the past few weeks, and they do present the challenge. That's, incidentally, one of the reasons that Israel doesn't want to see Fatah fall in the West Bank is because they know that the victor from that scenario is Hamas. So it's even worse. So Yeah, that's the catch-22, and that's, again, why so many people have clung to the status quo.
But how do you interpret, then, Prime Minister Netanyahu's discussion in the last couple of days leading into this election about imposing some sort of Israeli sovereignty over Jewish settlements in the West Bank, which are also internationally controversial, that Israel would support and claim territory within the West Bank, which is Palestinian territory? What is Prime Minister Netanyahu doing there, stoking the fire in some way?
A few things. First of all, what he said in Hebrew was taken fairly out of context and then spun up in the West quite a bit. He was basically saying an answer to a question that was about how come we have not, done this. Why hasn't he annexed portions of the West Bank in the past? Because remember, he's had the opportunity to do this for, about a decade, and he's not. He's more risk averse than most Israeli leaders that have been there. So he was asked about that, and he was certainly saying that that's something he would consider. That's number one. Number two, this is the run-up to an election. I discount a lot of the rhetoric there, like I discount the rhetoric here that happens right before an election. And much like the way I'm no fan of Erdogan in Turkey, but they just had an election, and his type of bombacity was at a level 11 in the week going up before the election. And that's something you just expect. So I don't make much of that. But at the same time, the Golan Heights recognition on the U.S. side put a dagger in the land for peace formula, where Israel is supposed to give back 100% of the land. That was set up with Egypt in that peace process in the late 70s. So there is ground now for Netanyahu to stand on, were he to do that. But we don't know all of the formulas that would be happening in the context of a Trump administration peace proposal. And I think any moves that Netanyahu would make would be okayed or approved or certainly passed by the Trump administration first, since the U.S. is, of course, the number one ally.
That's Matthew Brodsky, a Middle East expert and senior fellow at the Security Studies Group. We spoke earlier today, and since then, voting has ended in Israel, and early exit polls show the race too close to call. Both Prime Minister Netanyahu's Likud party and his main rival, Benny Gantz of the Blue and White Party, are declaring victory on social media in that parliamentary election. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next,